Hey, Sound Opinions listeners, if you support us on Patreon, you get to listen to our podcast ad-free on Patreon.
One, two, tres, cuatro.
You're listening to Sound Opinions, and this week we're paying tribute to our late friend and colleague, audio engineer Mary Gaffney. I'm Jim DeRogatis.
And I'm Greg Cott. We'll share some snippets from sessions she engineered for us, ranging from Jenny Lewis to Bob Mould. But first, our thoughts.
Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
Greg, Mary's one of the most fascinating people I've had the pleasure to meet in radio, and I know you feel the same way. Born in Milwaukee, right, went to high school in Maryland, and later attended the Peabody Institute, it was at the time, in Baltimore, studying music and voice. Mary loved music. And she became a recording engineer, first working at WFMT, the classical station in Chicago. And Tori Malatia, our mentor and friend, brought her to BEZ. She was an institution at BEZ, and the recording studio there on Navy Pier was her domain. Do not put your coffee on the mixing desk or anywhere near it. Mary helmed many sessions for us when we recorded live on Navy Pier, and she just rolled with every punch, whether it was a stone-cold punk band like Off coming in, or, great singer-songwriter like Jenny Lewis. Mary, I think, preferred the singer-songwriters, but any challenge we ever threw at her, recording Mission of Burma, getting guff from other colleagues on the pier about the noise, Mary was like, well, put up with it. We're doing this session. And she would save, if you remember this, Greg, she would save the water cups and mark them with a piece of masking tape of artists that she admired. I mean, she had one from Yoko Ono.
Right, right.
Mary could have made music herself. I mean, she once sang the national anthem at a Cubs game with Harry Carey, and sang with Steve Goodman. You know that story.
Yeah, well, she was one of those people who would always jump in, whatever it took. I was always impressed with how cool Mary was, no matter what we threw at her. And we threw some, there's some bands that, unconventional, projects, bands setting up quickly, bands playing different instruments.
Arcade Fire with like a dozen instruments.
And whatever the task was at hand, Mary could handle it. The curiosity was always the thing that struck me. It wasn't like, oh, why are we doing this? It doesn't fit into my model of what a band should be. This is interesting. This is a woman who, with one of her first paychecks, bought a tape recorder so she could tape animal sounds and bird calls and, and go into caves exploring. She was doing field recordings, from an early age and, was mentored by recording engineers in Chicago. Got into it sort of by accident, I'm just fascinated by this. People were willing to teach her. She became a pioneer in the field of the recording engineers in the United States. 5% are women.
Right.
That's today.
That's an insulting statistic. I'm always shocked by it. So few women sound engineers in the clubs, much less the recording studios.
Well, I had an intern, Lindsay Havens, who is now a senior editor at Billboard. How are you, Lindsay? We're proud of you.
Hey, Lindsay, that was a great piece.
She did a great piece for me and the Chicago Tribune in 2015 on Mary. Said, let's do a piece on Mary Gaffney. She's terrific. And she did this broader piece about how women generally don't have a role in recording studios, but she was one of the ones who did. And she said, you know, it surprised me to find out that there were so few of us.
Yeah.
But it didn't stop me, you know. And the other thing, the other highlight quote for me was, sounds just excited my mind. She was talking about these field recordings she was doing. My mind just keeps trying to identify and hear and scrutinize what's being in front of it. So her jumping in to do background harmonies on a Steve Goodman record was just par for the course.
It was just all another about day at the office
and getting and just being like, I did something really cool today.
Yeah.
You know, and that every day was like that for her.
I did get the impression, Greg, that the town of Newbold in northern Wisconsin, which is where she passed at the age of 72 on September 4, you know, being out in the woods, that was her true joy. And we have some audio that highlights that.
Anybody want to move for me? Come on, move.
I think the first time I recorded some nature sounds might have been when I was in Kansas recording my grandmother. And on the way to the hotel, there was a pen full of cows, and I stopped by the side of the road and recorded them. And when I got to the hotel, everyone was worried that I was late, and I told them I had to stop and record cows. And cows? They got a big kick out of that. Since they were farmers, I can't imagine any reason why someone would want to do that. I guess I would consider myself somewhat of a sound catcher. Like, you hear stories of storm catchers that go out and chase hurricanes and things like that. What I do is the same, but in sound. I don't know what it is I like about geese. Certainly they're vocal critters. It was up in Wisconsin, and I was doing a lot of recording jobs up in Wisconsin, so on my off time, I would go up to the marsh to see them come in, and then eventually just started to want to collect them. Initially, I went out at sunrise to get away from sound of man, the airplanes and cars and things, because the road goes right through the marsh. In first collecting in the morning, you hear a murmur of geese in the background. But you also hear the grass in the wind and lots of other birds. And I don't know, I was really lucky the one day when I went out and got a cow and a dog and all these other little birds and geese coming up with the sun. And you can tell as the day goes on, different birds live and start their songs. The first thing you'll notice is all these pops, you know, which to me I'm going, oh God, they're shooting these geese. Later in the day when I was in town, I asked like the pharmacist, what are all those gunshots? And he swore to me that there's no hunting, certainly not in the marsh, and that he felt that those were cannons that farmers have set off periodically to keep the geese from landing in their fields and eating the grain. The one sound that I go back every year to try to catch is the sound of the wind in the wings. And to me, I found that really amazing that you could hear it. It's actually not a pretty sound. It's like a little squeaky sound. It just... During the prime viewing, which is like about an hour before sunset, the cars just line along the road. Traffic is just stop watching the geese come in. They come in from all over. You'll see them gently start coming in, and then eventually there's bigger and bigger flocks. And as they're flying in, there's a flutter they do from side to side. It's called maple leafing, which is real pretty. And they land differently than ducks. Ducks slam into the water and geese kind of gently drop in. It certainly gets very noisy, and the numbers of the geese in prime time in about mid-October just gets overwhelming. Thousands and thousands of them. I listen to this in the morning. I try to subject house guests to it. But in the morning, I find being able to visit with nature a very good way to start the day. It's become a tradition. I just go to see the hills and the trees changing colors and try to get to the marsh by late afternoon and get a better, clearer recording. But I'm still looking for the wind in the wings.
Man, it is great to hear Mary talk again and talk about her passion for nature and recording it. That was a chat with Joanna Zorn from 1995, our friend and colleague at BEZ for many years. When we come back, we'll share some excerpts from sessions Mary engineered for us on Sound Opinions.
After all the jets. Sound Opinions is supported by Goose Island. Since 1988, Goose Island's been brewing beers in the spirit of Chicago.
You can find IPAs, lemonade, shandy, and limited releases in-store or at one of Goose's venues in Chicago. Goose Island Beer Company, Chicago's beer. Sound Opinions is supported by Goose Island. Since 1988, Goose Island has been brewing award-winning beers in Chicago that are inspired by this city. Take 312 Lemonade Shandy, Tropical Beer Hug Double IPA, and a rotating series of hazy IPAs only available in Chicago. Every time we go down to Goose Island, there's another one that they're pushing on us.
That's right.
They're all good.
Absolutely. And what supporters of musical culture, in the city of Chicago and elsewhere, if you go to a show in Chicago and you see that Goose Island sign, you know you're in good hands. They're music fans as well as great beer makers at Goose Island. So we're really proud to be associated with them.
The Goose Island Beer Company, Chicago's beer. And we are back. This week, we're bidding farewell to Mary Gaffney, a top-notch audio engineer we had the pleasure of working with for a decade and a half at WBEZ. Now we're going to revisit some of the episodes we recorded with her. We think these are classics, well worth hearing again. And we're starting off with an excerpt of one of our first shows, episode 19, back in 2006, with singer-songwriter Jenny Lewis. Jenny had just left Rilo Kiley, where people thought they had her pegged. Power pop, all right? Now she is going out as a solo singer-songwriter. Solo, except for the Watson twins were backing her.
We both were huge fans, Jenny. Greg and I reviewed it on the show a couple weeks ago, your solo debut, Rabbit Fur Coat. And I guess we wanted to start by just asking about the differences in striking out on your own as a solo artist with this record and being a member leader of Rilo Kiley and the timing. Why now?
Well, I think some of the differences are probably obvious. When you're in a band situation, it's more of a collaborative process. And writing the songs initially, I tend to kind of do that on my own, but then I bring them to the band and everything is up for discussion. But with this, I think just the songs, it was more of a private process, and the recording process was a lot more laid back, and there wasn't a whole lot of debate over what exactly would happen. We just kind of let it flow. But with this record, I started writing the songs while we were finishing up More Adventurous. And I kind of realized that it would be a long time before I would be able to record them, and I didn't want to forget them, so I went in the studio.
So what about the timing of this record, Jenny? Rilo Kiley's last album, More Adventurous, had quite a bit of success, sold about 100,000 copies. You headlined at the Coachella Festival last summer. Nice gradual build to that record. Your career appeared to be peaking. Your record company must have been thrilled that you decided your next move was a solo record as opposed to another Rilo Kiley record.
You know, I think hopefully everyone understands that this is kind of a part of what we've always done in Rilo Kiley. Jason plays drums with Bright Eyes. Blake just put out his second Elected record. So I think this allows us to keep the band going, and we always feel rejuvenated when we come back. So I think everyone understands that it's in the band's best interest to be able to go off and explore these other musical options, I guess.
Cool. Still, you're a generous collaborator. You give co-billing on the record to the Watson twins, and Chandra and Lee are here. What was that collaboration like in the studio? I mean, were they in the, were you hearing their harmonies as you were writing the songs?
Well, initially we got together for the first time. I was asked to participate in a Hootenanny. It was actually Jonathan's show, and a bunch of our friends who are songwriters were getting together, and we were to play three songs each. And I was a little afraid to play by myself. And I remembered singing with the girls with Rilo Kiley years before. So we got together and figured out, I think it was three songs. And it went so well, and it was so easy that they just became more and more a part of the record. But it was a real collaborative process coming up with the ideas. And I had some specific, some key words. I think just in writing songs, I tend to want to cram a lot of ideas and words in there. And it allowed me to kind of take a break and to have them continue the lyrical thought. So I had some initial ideas, and then we worked together, and it was easy.
So Jonathan's one of your guitarists who's here with
you. He is, Jonathan Rice.
Okay, and you have a pedal steel player.
Lap steel. That's right. Farmer Dave over there.
No pedal involved in Farmer Dave's lap steel. Why don't you guys play us a tune and we'll chat a little more?
Sure.
This is Swell Digs, huh? Our boss is here, so we have to mention this is the Jim and Kay Maybe Studios. We were having so much fun abusing this place. Usually it's like classical jazz musicians, you know.
Right. Who are the Maybes?
I don't know. We're going to have to find this out.
I don't know, but
they paid for the joint, so it's all right. They're cool by us, man.
Yeah.
What are you changing? Who do you think you're changing? You can't change things. We're all stuck in our ways. It's like trying to clean the ocean. What do you think you can drain it? Well, it was poison and dry long before you came. But you can wake up younger under the knife, and you can wake up sounder if you get analyzed. And I better wake up. There, but for the grace of God, go I. It's hard to believe your prophets when they're asking you to change things. But with their suspect lives, we look the other way. Are you really that pure, sir? Thought I saw you in Vegas. It was not pretty, but she was. But she will wake up wealthy. And you will wake up for. Escape that way, the windows are in flames. And what's that on your ankle? You say they're not coming for you, but house arrest is really just the same. Like when you wake up behind the bar, trying to crushed all the pretty things. They're but for the grace of God go I. But I
That was a Mary Gaffney-engineered recording session with Jenny Lewis and the Watson Twins. I remember that session very vividly because Lewis, a little bit of anxiety. She was going out on her own, and there was like the harmonies with the Watson Twins were key to that. And I remember Mary was, this is like right in her wheelhouse.
Oh, yeah.
I come from this stuff, this harmony singing, you know, the folk scene in Chicago, et cetera. So this was a, she loved that gig, I remember. And Jenny was really right at home. I remember her being very complimentary after it finished about how easy it was to do, how much fun it was.
Well, and I think that a female artist in particular related to Mary. Not that she was warm. She was all business in the recording. I mean, she was very warm to us, but she was all business in the recording studio. That was her domain. But I think she set people at ease just by virtue of her professionalism. You know, next up, we're going to revisit our 2006 session with film composer and producer John Bryan. Some of his work includes the scores to Magnolia and Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. He is a fascinating producer. So here is a super producer who is working with Mary Gaffney at public radio in the middle of the day, and it just sounded great. And it was a live event. We had people in the studio, if you recall, Greg, which always was an added hurdle we would throw Mary's way.
Yeah, that just adds another wild card to the scenario. And, you know, obviously a grand piano. We have a beautiful grand piano. We had one at the BZ Studios, which were a joy to work with. And John Bryan, again, feeling right at home in an unfamiliar setting, but Mary made it as easy as possible for him to sound great.
You talk about a lost art, songwriting. The whole Hollywood, or just a movie soundtrack in itself, has become sort of a lost art. How do you do that? How do you do that well? As opposed to let's call up the latest hot band to write a kickoff song for the new Godzilla blockbuster, you know?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's more the fault of the filmmakers and the movie companies than the film composers. There are a ton of talented people on the West Coast who can do anything that's asked of them. And for the most part, what's being asked of them is to be typical. And most of their paychecks depend on homogeny. And, you know, that's not their fault specifically. I've just been lucky in that I've worked with people who are mavericks and mavens and stand up for themselves. I mean, Paul Thomas Anderson is a guy who basically won't allow any movie people onto the set or any recording session. And I didn't even realize this was special because I started with Paul. And it's only in the intervening years where I realized there are always producers around. There's always somebody visiting from the movie company. They always have to have an opinion. But the film guys have it tough. It's a very, very thankless job. And I think the only reason I've gotten to do some things that have maybe stood out a little bit is because I've aligned myself with people who are trying to do that in every choice they make.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Charlie Kaufman and Michelle Gondry and Paul Thomas Anderson and David O. Russell. I mean, these are not people who are going around trying to make movies like everybody else. In fact, they wake up in the morning going, how am I going to do something different? I've been lucky. All I've generally heard in my career is somebody doesn't go, hey, how can you make that sound more like Our Things? If anything, they're going to be as quick as me to point out, like, yeah, that just sounds like other movies. Which is beautiful. That's the kind of comment I want. I want somebody to call me if I'm, you know, being lazy. I want to get called on it.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, that's the obvious thing to do for the scene, and it's great, and you did it right, you know, in quotation marks.
Mm-hmm.
But come on, I mean, we've got the opportunity to do something here.
That's
and when somebody says that to you, it's like, you're an idiot not to rise to the occasion.
¶¶
you've got many avenues of expression, John, and the question is, you've written a number of songs since the last record came out.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen you perform a number of them over the years. Great stuff. And I guess the question to me is there part of you that needs to get that stuff out, or are you satisfied with the other stuff that you're doing artistically?
See, I don't feel... Okay, because I've never felt part of... what I call the rock myth and the sort of punk myth stuff. I'm not interested in it. If I didn't have everything else, I would probably have a little more burning drive, but I don't. I don't have personal ambition in that way of, I must get my records out. People must pay attention to them. People must say they're good. I must be doing that, and I better do it soon because, you know, it's too late already, isn't it? By the standard clock, I've already completely done it. I've done a very poor job with my career. And it's confusing for some people to understand. But, you know, there's a problem I've run into. People who know me as a producer first will actually sit down, like very kindly trying to talk to me so I can stop being so self-destructive. Like, you've got to, you know, why don't you just concentrate on that? I mean, the movie stuff, and it's cute you want to be a songwriter, but just do that. You know, you could be... You know, you could really make something of yourself. Honestly. And I'm talking people I really respect.
Yeah.
If people knew me as a songwriter first, okay, why are you so psychologically, willfully self-destructive as to not put out records all the time? You're one of my favorite songwriters. Why don't you do that more? Why are you wasting your time working for other people? It's really worrisome, and I think you really need to look into it, and you should stop doing these other things. The people who do movies... don't even notice that I'm a song, like, not even, it's not on their radar. The fact that I produce records doesn't matter. People who are doing movies are completely tunnel vision, not only about movies in general, but only their movie.
Right.
Nothing
right.
else exists.
Yet I believe she's lying. I trust her, undermine my faith in her in time. I have every confidence that she'll dismantle mine. Given time.
And for me, it's all fun and it's all wonderful. And if I'm lucky enough to not be hit by a bus, by the time my life's done, I'll probably have made as many records as a solo artist as most people make in their career. Because other people only make them as long as record companies are paying for them, promoting them, as long as audiences are showing up.
Right.
Only during the period for some people where there's a certain sort of vanity in it, like, well, you know, I look too old to be in a rock band now, so I can't really do that as much now. You know, the rock fans, that doesn't matter. In a week, I can work on a movie,
yeah,
play on somebody else's record, write a song with somebody, play a gig of my own, spend a day putzing around in a studio, maybe recording some of my own songs, maybe just making sound, and take 2 days off and see friends. But the fact is, I intend to do stuff until they put me in the ground.
Now here's one last performance from John Bryan, the theme music from the film Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, live on Sound Opinions back in 2006.
Thank you.
That was a little bit of John Bryan and another Mary Gaffney session in front of an audience at the BEZ Studios. When we come back, more of some of Mary's great work, including conversations with the Mekons and Bob Mould on Sound Opinions. If I run uphill, I'm out of
breath. Remember in 2018 when Border Patrol separated thousands of refugee kids from their parents, deported those parents back to their home countries, and kept the kids in the United States? Believe it or not, 6 years later, there are still hundreds of families who have not yet been reunited.
Though we as a community may feel hopeless at times, we recently learned about an organization called Al Otro Lado, which works to reunify families. They provide holistic legal and humanitarian support to refugees, deportees, and other migrants in the U.S. and Tijuana through a multidisciplinary, client-centered, harm-reduction-based practice.
Since 2018, they've reunited over 100 refugee families ripped apart by the zero-tolerance policy of the previous administration. Once reunited, Al Otro Lado helps each family find legal representation, housing, and the counseling they need in order to heal and get back on their feet.
Imagine having your child ripped from your arms and never knowing when you would see them again. We can't let family separations go on. If you're like us and believe that all families belong together, then join us supporting Al Otro Lado and donate today.
You can find the link to donate to Al Otro Lado in the description of this episode, or go to gum.fm/charity and donate today. That's gum.fm/charity.
You can also consider volunteering with the organization, which offers opportunities that are both in-person and virtual. The best way to get involved is by filling out an application on their website, elotrolado.org/volunteer.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
And we're back. This week we're paying tribute to Mary Gaffney, our late friend and former colleague. Next, we're going to revisit a session Mary worked with us on in 2016, a conversation with one of my favorite bands, the Mekons. Got signed to a major label. They gave you a little, like a two-week promotional push, I believe, which may have been the only marketing campaign ever devoted to a Mekons record. And it was a really great record. I mean, I think a lot of people really loved that record if they'd heard it. And it probably still your bestseller to this day, I would imagine. I think it sold something like 30,000 copies at the time or something.
Which we
like
thought
that.
Was insanely, yeah. Insanely lavish, and they thought was ridiculously small. So, yeah.
So,
not a meeting of minds. Basically, the guy who signed us left almost immediately. And he had a kind of idea that he was going to bring independence into the kind of major label marketplace and give us small budgets and control. And just so we didn't have the kind of disasters we had of like independent distribution collapsing all the time. And
right.
So he was really good. We liked him. And then he left and went somewhere else because they wouldn't let him do what he wanted to do. But we were signed there. And then a bunch of accountants from LA came and like poked us with sticks and realized we were useless. So we asked if we could leave. And then they said,
we had
no,
a big fight.
Leave.
And they said the next album we did was substandard.
Right.
Which
was the curse of the Mekons, so they never put it out. But fortunately, we hadn't signed for the world. We'd only signed for America. So that album was never really released in America.
Yeah, the curse of the Mekons could only be gotten as an import immediately after your major label debut and finale. all in one. So the reason I'm asking this about the major label experience, you've been indie, independent almost all along. And, you know, Jim and I have referred to in various incarnations, the last punk band standing, things like this. And people said, they're not a punk band. They don't sound like punks. And I go, well, they're more punk than any band you could name. But you did form in that era. And I think there was a spirit that informed the bands more so than a sound. I want to ask you guys what that era meant to you in terms of your ideals and ethics when it came to making music and making art, you know, in terms of the way it informed the way you operate as a band.
I think there was definitely a kind of zero effect going on
with that time before punk happened. I, you know, I was obviously into music, but I never really saw it being something that I could actually do. It was only like really big bands did that. And then suddenly the whole ground was raised, you know, with what was happening with punk and the Sex Pistols and all of that. It suddenly kind of happened, you know. And I think it was really, really important because it just gave permission for anybody and everybody to do whatever they wanted to do. And it was not the whole stylization of what punk might be supposed to look like or sound like. It was obviously something that happened over time.
But I think of the bands we used to play with, like the Russell Club in Manchester, Tony Wilson was doing these nights, early factory nights, and we'd be there with, you know, the Slits were there one night when we were from the Gang of Four, but then we'd be like the Human League. Mm-hmm. From Sheffield, Cabaret Voltaire, there was this mad electronic scene there. Then there was these other bands from Scotland, like the Scars and the Fire Engines, and yeah, it was a very, you know, there wasn't a sound. It was just an idea.
There wasn't any rules. And if you look at the punk scene now, I don't know, maybe you know better than me, but it seems very formulaic. And you got to do this. You got to wear the jacket. But actually, in those days, it was very, very broad and open, and a lot of different things going on.
Well, sell us some Mekons music. What are you going to play?
We'll do the Last Dance from the Fear and Whiskey record. But actually, we'll do the version from the, what's it called?
The English Dancing Master.
The English Dancing Master.
Dance floor's nearly empty now. Everyone's gone home. We're fragmented and broken up like love affairs. And as if seeing you for the first time, something whispered. Looking at you in desperation, knowing nothing ever happens.
I wanted to say fall in love. I wanted to say fall in love with me. I wanted to say fall in love. It'll be alright.
You were waltzing, little frozen rivers all covered with snow. All fragmented and broken up. Oh well, I guess it's time to go.
I wanted to say fall in love. I wanted to say fall in love with me. I wanted to say fall in love. It'll be alright.
So beautiful. You were waltzing, little frozen rivers all covered with snow. All fragmented and broken up. Oh well, I guess it's time to go. But as if seeing you for the first time, something whispered. Looking at you in desperation, knowing nothing ever happens.
I wanted to say fall in love. I wanted to say fall in love with me. I wanted to say fall in love. It'll be alright. You were waltzing. Thank you.
Last Dance by the Mekons, live on Sound Opinions. John Langford, Tom Greenhall, Lou Edmonds. It's such a treat for us to have you guys here in the studio.
So the lineup of the Mekons has been very fluid for decades. I've heard the band described as not so much a band but a collective. What was your conception of what the Mekons were going to be? Was it a band in your mind? Was it something that was going to incorporate these many incarnations of art and multimedia as music? I mean,
it was just meant to be the opening band for the Gang of Four and a couple of gigs in 1977.
It was just meant to be very sort of democratic in the sense that there was no sort of qualifications required for anything to do it. So you didn't have to know how to play an instrument, for example, mm-hmm. to be able to be on stage playing an instrument. So, you know, it was very sort of free in that way. So there was absolutely no concept of anything going any further.
And was there a point where you thought this is... I know there was a period there in the early 80s where it was sort of like a little nip and tuck about whether or not this was ever going to continue. And I just wonder how many periods there were like that in the band where you felt like, well, the Mekons really don't exist for me anymore. Or was there always a feeling that there would be new work coming?
I think we were quite bloody minded at that point because we were sort of told, the industry had kind of told us we couldn't do it anymore, and it was,
we didn't deserve to exist.
So mm-hmm. So things like the Mekon story and then the English Dancing Master were kind of created almost entirely in the wilderness with no thought that anyone would ever hear.
The complete underground records with, where the band was just maybe three or four people.
And a social grouping, really.
And a social network of about 25 other people. That was it. That was literally it. There was no, the world was that small. But I was going to say initially, I think what started it all off was the fact that after literally our first and a half gig, we were approached to make a single. And that was like very strange. And that was, could only really have happened at that point in time, when it was all really kicking off. And that whole thing from just doing this thing because we were free to do it to then suddenly putting a record out and then suddenly the record being, Tony Parsons, NME Single of the Week, and John Peel playing it on the radio.
John Peel played it.
It all suddenly went,
changed things.
Immediately we had to sort of deal with all of that. And so it was a very steep sort of learning curve. But because we came from a certain... place and time and ideas of what we were doing, I think we've had to retain that to be able to function. And every time we've kind of lost that slightly, that's when it's gone wrong. All the major label kind of stuff,
So the only thing that could kill the Mekons would be success.
Possibly. We were the Chicago connection.
Depends what you mean by success, because I think we are very successful.
Yeah, yes, anyway. In that you create in your own terms and enjoy the process. I meant like making a money. Stinking rotten money.
I'd like to sort of see if we can resist.
You've got an open mind.
Yeah.
You'd be willing to give it a shot. The Mekons on Sound Opinions in 2016, we've had them on several times. That was a memorable session because we're in the big recording studio with Mary Gaffney. They've got like a dozen instruments, Greg, and nothing's throwing Mary. Not a problem. Anything there, The only thing that threw Mary is if you dared to put anything on that grand piano. I said earlier, the recording console, once in a while, I'm just like, we're juggling so much. We're talking to the audience. Sometimes there's also guests. Not even my notebook. My notebook was not going to do any damage to the grand. Don't put anything on the grand piano.
Yeah, well, it was definitely the most expensive piece of equipment in that studio, right?
For sure.
But a beauty. And the Mekons, of course, can play. They played on street corners. They played in, beer halls. This was kind of high-end for them, one of the great recording engineers in Chicago was working with them, so it was an easy session for her.
Let's go to another session from the same year, Greg, 2016, a chat and a live performance with Bob Mould and two of his band members, John Worster and Jason Narducci. This was also loud.
Like I said, Mary, you know, if you were gratuitously making noise, Mary would be angry at you. But when it's a when it's musicians that she is trying to capture accurately, she did not care about any of the public radio reporters complaining about the noise, you know, coming from the studio. No, I am doing this. This is important. Right. You know, get out of my face. I
yeah,
love it.
She was completely unfazed by that. It was more of like an interesting challenge rather than a
yeah.
chore.
Yeah.
She always wanted to dig in and see how I can do the best possible job.
You've said that you needed solitude and to get your head together and recover from some trials in your life. Mm-hmm. The last album was a lot about the loss of your father. There were other problems this time. But the word I've seen you use again and again when talking about that dark place is, these songs are my salvation. The guitar gets me out of it. You know, I find it so inspiring. That
Thanks.
I mean, you know, you're all of like 5 or 6 years older than me, right? But at this stately age, elder statesman of rock, you still need this. This gets you out of a hole.
Yeah, yeah. Music saves all of our lives, I would like to hope and think and pray that it does. You know, it's, you know, when I was a small child, it was the thing that, you know, sort of covered up all the chaos around me. I was sort of just fold myself into these 45s and sit and memorize label copy and melodies and figure out what all of it meant. It was all very mysterious as a child. And then I get older and you get big albums and you read words and you see images. And then all of a sudden you hear the Ramones and you go, wow, anybody can do this.
Yeah.
Just that simplicity and that unity that they presented, you know, sort of showed me, said, you know, get off of that other stuff you're listening to.
Yeah.
Get a voice. Like
but, you know,
that.
Above and beyond that, that Lou Reed song, Rock and Roll, Jenny said she was just 5 years old. Her life was saved by rock and roll. You still believe that? A life
yeah.
can be saved by this music.
Yeah, if not for these songs, I don't think I would have had a very good 6 months at the beginning of 2015. Hmm. When things are really dark and thing, you know, questioning yourself a lot about your life and about what you've done and loss, sickness, you know, changes. You know, to be able to get up in the morning and go down a couple flights of stairs and tuck myself into this little room and make music. And, you know, on the good days, I'm there for 12 hours before I realize I've done anything.
Mm. Seems like five minutes, yeah.
Yeah, it seems like 5 minutes. And at the end, you hope it's just 3 minutes that you can share with people. And, you know, some days you go down there and 16 bars of nonsense and it's time to go take a walk. But, you know, it's, yeah, I think music is, it's an incredibly powerful force in all of our lives. You know, any of us who take it seriously and live and die for it. That's what it's all about.
His parents, they can't understand why the son he turned out wrong. He runs away from all the pain and forgets them when he's gone. He'd rather be all by himself because his plans, they seem the best. He finally gets the mirror blended, now life becomes a test. Whatever you want, whatever you do, wherever you go, whatever you say. Whatever you want, whatever you do,
well, it also seems like the contrast is such a big part of your vocabulary as a songwriter. I just remember first time listening to something like Zen Arcade, and it was cathartic listening to the music, and then you dug deeper and you go, wow, this guy's going through some stuff in these songs.
Yeah.
And it's been that way for a while. These records are, when you listen to the new record, on the surface, Patch the Sky is a very uplifting, majestic kind of record. But you dig deeper into those lyrics, and there's some... This narrator of these songs is a troubled dude.
Yeah.
So that seems to be like...
Who wrote these anyway?
That's a kind of, that's kind of
I don't
a...
I don't want to be in the same room
yeah.
as that guy.
Stop laughing, Bob.
But it seems like that's necessary. I'm in a dark mood, but I don't want to write dark music with it.
Yeah, I think that's... For many, many years, that's what I unknowingly did. And then when it was presented to me, you know, much like the Threes, you know, when it was presented to me that I... Oh, you write these such dark words, but these so bright melodies, you know? And then I was like, oh, yeah, 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 yeah. And then, you know, a number of years go by and you sort of run from that. And then when, you know, you double back and, you know, you come to the realization that that's how I appear best is when I do that. So that contrast on this record has turned up very high. And I like that. I mean, I get hooks in my head. You know, all of us get those, I think, that love music. We get those little earworms and... You know, I know that's not a favorite word, but, you know, just those melodies that you can't shake, and I get them in my head all the time, and, you know, to be able to share those and have that as a nice, soft landing for these harsh realities that I think as we all get older, we sort of have to deal with.
Right. We've talked in the past about this whole idea of, like, you go back to your 45s when you're
hit a wall or, you know, just for inspiration purposes. And it's interesting that that three-minute pop single, I mean, the Rolling Stones were writing pop singles in the 60s. Whatever great band that you can think of, they all came out in the 45 RPM format with a song.
Yeah, so it's just like I try to impart to people, you know, when I talk about having a vinyl collection, and people are always like, but you have to move it every time you move. I'm like, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. That's when you realize the meaning of it. You know, people don't throw records away so much, do they? I mean, people throw digital files away all the time.
I will never part with my Husker Du 8 Miles High single.
No, the warm-up song for Zen Arcade.
Yeah.
That's always my favorite. When people, how did you do that? I was like, well, it was our sound check.
Yeah.
Give us everything you got on that vocal. Let's get those levels right.
So play us a song that good, Bob.
All right, one more. All right.
The years of our lives, the time we invest, yeah, wasted away in a post-lap dream. Came home at night.
Bob Mould, recorded by Mary Gaffney, which wraps up our tribute to our friend, longtime recording engineer, Mary. We're going to miss you, Mary. Thank you for everything you did. Greg, what do we have on the show next week?
You remember we had a show about songs about mourning, right?
That was good times. People have been giving us all sorts of other suggestions online.
Very well received. So now we got to give the other part of the day its due. We're going to do some songs about night.
Okay, all right. That makes sense.
So, and don't forget to check out our bonus podcast feed wherever you get your podcasts.
The views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this program belong solely to Sound Opinions and not necessarily to Columbia College Chicago or our sponsors. Thanks, as always, to our Patreon supporters. Sound Opinions is produced by Andrew Gill, Alex Claiborne, and our associate producer, Sol Delgadillo. Our Columbia College intern is Max Hatlam, and our social media consultant is Katie Kai.